This week on Your Western Context, Kenny walks a tightrope with unpopular restrictions. Horgan ignores a major logging protest in his riding, and Trudeau attempts to blame the provinces for poor vaccine rollouts. Also, Trudeau continues to stonewall testimony on the We Charity scandal. This is Western Context, episode 214, recorded Friday, April 9th, 2021. Choose your own democracy. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back yet again this week, and this week is a week that seems to have carried on from last week in terms of the news, and everything we have had has effectively grown like a snowball would.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the news that has happened this week has just continued from last week, as you said, where new aspects of the story have cropped up, and we certainly have a lot of refreshers to go on, and some interesting news that's come out that that really should have been talked about in the media a lot more than it had been, where a lot of the times the Canadian media was silent on a lot of these issues.
Yeah, and of course, that's what we aim to do each and every week here at Western Context. Our goal is to provide that information and context that is missing, and in doing so, hopefully remove all the media bias and sensationalism that you find in the news that you read. And in doing so, we want to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. We need to just underscore with this is that when it comes down to talking about these stories, we're often in a position where it's going against what the media is saying. And just because it goes against what the conventional wisdom says doesn't mean that one side, whether what the media is saying or what other people are saying, is right. What we're aiming to do here is, of course, just shine the light on the entire picture of what's happening with this. And, you know, we saw suggestions through the Easter long weekend that Alberta needed to improve what they were doing in terms of COVID-19 restrictions. And this has resulted in a whole boatload of stories from Alberta this week, ranging from people going against the restrictions to those in Jason Kenney's own UCP caucus going against the restrictions as well and expressing their displeasure with them. Now, of course, this week the province announced a new batch of restrictions in order to attempt to blunt the recent uptick in cases, and these, for the most part, are the same restrictions that Dr. Bonnie Henry brought in last week in BC, with the exception of religious gatherings in Alberta being limited to 15% capacity, but we'll get there in a moment as to just how that factors into this story. Now, as you'll recall, the reaction in BC was that this was called a circuit breaker lockdown after the BC government brought it in, while in Alberta here, the opposition, NDP, and media are saying that we still need a circuit breaker, despite the fact that most of the restrictions that are now in place between the two provinces are almost identical. And this, of course, speaks to the difference in media narrative between the two provinces and the administrations at hand in the way they're treated by the media. COVID restrictions have the province split, likely down the urban-rural divide, and the divide is also penetrated into the UCP caucus, but we'll get to that very soon. Now, on Sunday last week, health inspectors paid a visit to Street Church in southeast Calgary, where they were confronted by Pastor Arthur Pawlowski, who did not let the health inspectors in, who were also happened to be accompanied by Calgary Police Service members. A video of the encounter was posted to YouTube and quickly went viral online, and you can see the full video in our show notes. Put simply, this video had the pastor not allowing the health inspectors to enter his church and had some very choice words for them. But you can, of course, find that in the full show notes at westerncontext.ca. Now, with this has also proved to be an interesting learning experience for us here at Western Context, because this week we learned that it's actually a violation of the Criminal Code of Canada under Section 176 to disrupt a member of the clergy, religious worship, or anyone meant for moral, social, or benevolent purposes. And this is, of course, what many people have been saying all along, is that if health inspectors come in and try and break up a worship service as it's happening, or try and prevent a service from starting, they could probably get caught under this. Now, while the argument can be made for health reasons that the province can temporarily suspend these rites, those operating religious houses of worship certainly do seem to have a case to pursue in the courts. Now, after the restrictions were announced on Tuesday, on Wednesday the following day, Alberta Health Services shut down Grace Life Church by fencing it off, which is a church just west of Edmonton. And this is a church that's been ticketed many times for violating restrictions, and their pastor, James Coates, spent 35 days in the Edmonton Remand Center. The church is being represented by the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms, who feels the church has a case to stay open and the closure violates constitutional rights. Supporters of the church have gathered outside recently and have no intention of relenting. The church ultimately received 105 complaints since last July, and for Alberta Health Services, this was reportedly the final infraction. Rebel News interviewed Pastor Coates as the pastors decided to not talk to any of the mainstream media for fear of being taken out of context. We have this interview as well posted in our show notes. Alberta Health Services Enforcement operates independently of the government cabinet. This means it's Alberta Health Services, the organization, which is an organization that's set up by the government, not Jason Kenney, not the health minister, Tyler Shandro, or even the COVID cabinet, that makes these decisions of when infractions go too far and a place of worship or any other business is going to be shut down. NDP leader Rachel Notley on this said that she was glad to finally see Alberta Health Services taking steps to enforce the public health orders at Grace Life Church, and that the Grace Life Church members need to take this opportunity, in her words, to learn from the leadership of so many other communities. Now, Jason Kenney was well aware that many in the community, and in fact his own party, would be against these new restrictions when they were brought out. These restrictions are fracturing the province, and the media has only inflamed the problem this week. Now, put simply, the media would love nothing more than to see the UCP crash and burn as a result of divisions due to COVID policies. And they've certainly done their effort for that. On Wednesday, 15 UCP MLAs signed a letter requesting a regional approach to restrictions. They also raised the concerns of their constituents and called on the province to follow a, quote, transparent path forward that provides certainty to Alberta families, communities, and businesses. Following the letter, an additional two MLAs added their names in support. And as for the media's part on this, this has been branded as a UCP revolt, and the NDP also had their own clever branding associated with it as well that took on some traction in the media. Now, looking at this from the perspective of how the legislature operates, NDP leader Rachel Notley has called for all the MLAs to be expelled from the UCP caucus, but Jason Kenney takes a different stance on this, and he understands that a diverse pool of views exist in his party, and in his own words, what those MLAs were doing was giving voice to those concerns about the very real negative consequences of restrictions. And he also said that he respects their responsibility as elected representatives to articulate concerns like that. He also said, and this was made clear after the fact, from the media's perspective, that the line for them being kicked out of the caucus would be either encouraging civil disobedience or encouraging others to break restrictions. Now, this is a rather interesting turn of events and the interest the NDP is taking in this, because while the NDP was in power, one of their own MLAs, Robin Luff, was removed from the NDP caucus for alleging bullying at the hands of Rachel Notley and not being able to properly represent her own constituents. Now, what we see here in the case of Robin Luff versus these 17 MLAs is completely the opposite situation in terms of being how it's handled by leadership. The premier is encouraging the MLAs to represent their constituents, yet the media is vilifying him. When the opposite happened in 2018, the NDP were in power, and the media gave this story a break, and I think we actually possibly discussed this here on Western Context at the time. Now, calling this a revolt is a step too far. If the MLAs actually cross the floor to sit as independents or form some other political party or introduced a motion of non-confidence in the government, then we could call it a revolt. But this is just democracy functioning as intended, where MLAs of the legislature, 87 people, are supposed to represent the 4.5 million people that live in Alberta. And if they don't represent those people, one should ask, who is going to represent them? So these MLAs are actually doing the job that they were hired to do by their constituents in the 2019 elections. Albertans ultimately want to see these views orchestrated because there have been a number of businesses throughout the entirety of the province that have opted to challenge restrictions. And this is something that we'll be following further on here on Western Context to see just how many of them there turn out to be and if there's any major infractions issued by Alberta Health Services and what the government and media response would be on that. Now, of course, you would be remiss in thinking that this is just a phenomenon that's actually happening only in Alberta, but it's not. Patrons at a restaurant in Vancouver actually shouted out health inspectors when the restrictions in BC were due to come into effect. So this is something that's happening elsewhere, not just in Alberta. And this raises the interesting point. For restrictions to work, for the increase in cases of the virus to be blunted, there has to be public buy-in. Because as we see, most everything here in Alberta remains the same this week, but tensions are on the rise because of the media narrative that we've seen. We'll have to see if these new restrictions do actually limit the uptick in cases and which way the UCP goes in relation to either continuing on with the restrictions or perhaps listening to the 17 or so MLAs who want to see restrictions lessened. But Albertans need to remember that it could be a whole lot worse. We could have curfews, we could have mandated stay-at-home orders, and for the liberty-minded, we need to remember that the real person to not oppose here is Jason Kenney and the UCP. It's actually Justin Trudeau, Rachel Notley, the media, and everybody else who's using this pandemic to raise divisions amongst those who are genuinely concerned about livelihoods.
Yeah, I think that when we saw the news come out about Jason Kenney enacting restrictions again in Alberta, I think everybody across the country would know that if any province is going to have a significant number of people that are against restrictions, it's probably going to be Alberta. But past the stereotypes, it's pretty clear that what these MLAs are doing is just trying to represent their constituents who have raised these issues themselves. It's the same sorts of thing we see on a national level when we have contentious issues that are being raised by rural MPs that go against what their own party wants. For instance, with the Liberals, could be gun control, where a lot of rural Liberal ridings have had MPs that are actually against what their party is for when it comes to gun control. And, you know, this is the same sort of thing where we have parliamentarians that are trying to represent their constituents. And lots of people say, well, we want our politicians to represent us, but this just happens to be one particular aspect of that. And as you mentioned, it's not just in Alberta that it's happening. There's lots of different places in BC where there have been lots of pushback, especially by the restaurant industry, against these crippling restrictions that could see them lose their businesses. I mean, we're already over a year into this, and another shutdown for restaurants could spell the death knell for these businesses who are already teetering on the edge of bankruptcy as it is. So when you look at it in that regard, you can understand why these people are wanting to remain in business when it's their livelihoods that are on the line. And I think that governments have to have a huge balancing act when it comes to trying to curb infection rate, but also trying to not put any more businesses into bankruptcy, because the economy in whatever province you are, it has to be teetering on the edge at this point. And we have to maintain that balance. And, well, governments around the country are still trying to find what that balance is.
Yeah, and this underscores a very key point that throughout this entire thing since we started last March, there's been a multitude of things tried, not just in Canada, not just in our provinces, but throughout the world. Various things were tried in the same areas and got entirely different outcomes in terms of the ability to curb cases. And, you know, it's not going to be until after this thing is all said and done that we're going to be able to see exactly why those things shook out the way they did. But at this point, and we've said this since the very beginning, everything that's being done to try and curb cases is in effect being done blind. Because what worked last spring and what worked last fall might not necessarily work this year, given the way the public feels in terms of the buy-in they're offering up and also just the amount of sheer viral spread that's out there due to the increasing prevalence of the variants. So as we always say here at Western Context, you can say that a leader is doing very good or very bad in terms of how they're handling this, but there are a few basic key things that you either get right or wrong. And the biggest thing is that there needs to be buy-in support from the public. And if that doesn't exist, you're going to see cases like this happening of what we have here in Alberta. And it's going to pose an interesting discussion about which way the governments go going forward.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever you see the public going against a major decision, it's incumbent on the government to either they have to explain themselves better, in which case they had a messaging problem in the first place, or they have to walk back their restrictions, or their decisions, whatever it may be. And in that case, that leaves them looking like they didn't make a good decision in the first place, and that they didn't do their homework on the issue. So in either case, it's something that a lot of governments have to make a good decision on the first time around, because when it comes to things like curbing an infection rate, the politicians can make the rules, but those rules have to actually do what they're supposed to do. And if the public is not wanting to follow those rules, well, it's leading to a lot of pointless shutdowns that don't really have an effect. And that's just something that we've seen in this past few months, probably since winter, where a lot of people are just getting tired of what's going on. And we're seeing the very slow vaccine rollout by the federal government. And, well, I mean, people are getting tired of it. And we're reaching the point in certain parts of the world where there were riots in North Ireland, mainly due to one of this being the issue, is that they were just tired of staying at home. And while we don't condone riots here, but we have to make sure that governments will do what they can to make sure that tensions do not rise. And currently that's what's happening in Alberta this week.
Yeah, and there's not much help from the mainstream media on that, which is, you know, the most unfortunate thing, that if you take any of these stories that were mentioned on Supplemental, you see that's exactly what the media was doing. And that's what we here at Western Context point out each and every week. And if you want to help us do that, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Western Context. There we offer three tiers of support. For $2 a month, the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that, but have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, you might be wondering, what are we going to do with this? Well, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So with that, we're heading over to Vancouver Island now to talk more about old growth forests.
Yes, exactly. And to transition from the last story, when we talked about governments making decisions, they have to make sure that those decisions are something that the public agrees with. Otherwise, there's going to be a huge rising tension against them. And, well, there's a decision that the BC government could have made at any point in the last year, especially since I first started talking about it, but it's something that they haven't. And, well, we've seen the end result of that now. When BC makes international news, it's usually for something good, but sometimes it's something really bad, and this time it's the latter. Now, last episode, at the end of my skewering of John Horgan's failed pandemic response, along with raising taxes that disproportionately affect the working poor, I also had a footnote that the BC Supreme Court has decided to uphold an injunction against the Fairy Creek logging blockaders. Now, I've talked about the ongoing logging of old-growth forests on Vancouver Island in the past, notably on episode 183 in the summer, as well as 197 last November. So, this is really not a new issue, neither for Western context nor for the province, and the BC NDP government of John Horgan has had plenty of time to address the issue, and he has not, and now the world's eyes are on BC for our government's failure to protect our most precious, valuable, and irreplaceable ecosystems. Now, The Guardian, which is based out of the UK, ran with a story on Friday with a tagline, "War in the Woods." Other international outlets have covered the story, and numerous high-profile celebrities have taken to social media to highlight the struggle, which is located in a remote corner west of Victoria, BC. Now, this injunction was granted by the BC Supreme Court on April 1st, and we noted it last week that it was not actually a joke and that it was actually something that happened and not a result of April Fool's Day. It orders the demonstrators to take down the blockades that they had set up to prevent forestry company Teal Jones from accessing its logging operation in the area. Now, photographer and actor Cole Sprouse, who films the TV show Riverdale in BC, which there's actually a lot of movie productions happening in and around Victoria in the past 2 weeks, and a lot of these actors have also lent their support to the local activists. Cole Sprouse, for his part, he learned about the story from local activists, and he actually visited the forest in the days leading up to the injunction, and he wanted to capture its vast ancient trees and its defenders. Now, Glenn Reed, who is a camp manager with the Rainforest Flying Squad, one of the groups that is protesting the old-growth logging, said on Thursday from Fairy Creek that fundraising for the group has actually surpassed $200,000, and that food donations are arriving daily, and support is coming in from celebrities such as Academy Award-winning actor Mark Ruffalo from the Avengers series, former wrestler Hulk Hogan, and musicians Bruce Coburn and Midnight Oil, who have given organizers permissions to use their songs on social media. Now, one of the protesters noted that this area was actually part of Premier John Horgan's own riding, and that he should listen to his constituents. Now, Teal Jones, for their matter, is speaking out on the dispute between the company and the activists. Fairy Creek sits within Tree Farm License 46, which was established back in 1955. Now, Jack Gardner, who is a log broker and custom cutter with Teal Jones, notes that, quote, "Over 70% of the province's old growth is protected. You know, we believe in a balanced approach to a working forest." Now, the company says that it has only access to a very small portion of the Fairy Creek old growth forest area, and of that total, it only currently plans to log a small fraction of it. Fairy Creek only makes up about 1,200 hectares in total, and of the 200 hectares that are available for logging to Teal Jones, they say that they only currently plan to harvest 20 hectares. Activists, however, say it's unacceptable to log even a relatively small portion of the region. Joshua Wright, who is a spokesperson with the Rainforest Flying Squad, said, quote, "As Teal Jones points out, it's only a small section of the valley, but it's still an intact valley, and when you log a small section of that, it's no longer intact. Beyond that, we shouldn't be logging old-growth forests, period." It's interesting to note that the Teal Jones spokesperson noted that over 70% of the province's old growth is protected. But the problem when you look at percentages is a percentage of a very small amount is still a very small amount. And when you look at it, 97% of all of BC's old growth forest have already been logged, leading to only 3% remaining. So 70% of that being protected is still a very small amount. And the fact that they're trying to use statistics to make their case when they're very misleading, you know, it raises a lot of questions. So why should they be harvesting old growth trees in the first place? Well, Teal Jones says it's because the wood is easier to work with for high value products. The tighter the grain on the wood, the better, and the old growth timber provides that tighter grain, meaning that it won't crack when it is dried out to make specialty products. Protesters, however, say that the ends don't justify the means. Wright says, quote, "These quality wood products come from deforestation. They say that they're going to replant and that the trees will grow back, but you can't just grow back a 1,000-year-old tree." And that's really what it comes down to, is that these products that are being made from this wood are high-quality products. But the problem is that a lot of mills have closed in BC over the past few years since we started doing Western Context. And I've mentioned many times about mills being closed. So you have to wonder, where exactly are these logs headed to? Well, they're headed to either the United States, where they get shaped and sold back to us, or they're heading overseas to countries like China, where it is actually helping their industries get going faster and faster. And, well, a lot of people are thinking, well, should we support the logging if it's going to start creating jobs, and if it's going to help the housing bubble that's happening, where they're hoping that the logs will go to help create more houses? Well, it's really not. It's actually going overseas to create more houses in China. So that's really the heart of the issue here, is that the BC government has remained silent on this entire issue. Last fall, John Horgan made a plea to BC to elect him to a majority government so that he had the mandate to make tough decisions. Instead, he has not made the decisions necessary for this province over the past few weeks, and we hope that he will reconsider before his constituency loses valuable ecosystems forever.
Yeah, and you know, this is something that we see all the time here, that looking at BC in particular and the other side of the political spectrum from John Horgan, is that, you know, that it's often said that the Conservative Party of Canada doesn't have an environmental plan, or the UCP didn't have an environmental plan, or Doug Ford's environmental plan wasn't adequate enough. But you don't hear the story that John Horgan has this old growth forest that sits in his very own riding, that he claims to have been elected to make those tough decisions on, but he hasn't made the decision to protect that forest. And because of that, that is, of course, moving along a good number of the products, as you said, overseas. And, you know, we always talk about how the core economic benefits and the way the economy grew in Canada was our resource-based economy. And not only does that include energy, but it also includes things like forestry as well from BC. But at the same time, you have to do it in a sustainable fashion, as in you don't want to completely log all of the existing old growth that is there, as you said. Only 3% of it remains, and 70% to 3% is not a lot. And this is something that definitely should have gained media traction this week. You have to wonder if the Greens had anything to say to this, or if they just couldn't get their message out there at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think Green Party leader Sonia Furstenau was taking to Twitter, thanking all of the different celebrities for raising the issue on social media, and she was certainly speaking out against the issue as well. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to media reporting, they don't really go to the Green Party for these issues, and they still, even though they had a very very important role in the last legislature, where they were the kingmakers in a minority parliament, they aren't currently in that position anymore with the NDP elected to a majority government. They don't have to listen to the Greens. And certainly on this issue, they're not listening to the Greens whatsoever, because they've been speaking out on this quite a bit. Silence from the BC Liberals, actually, on this issue as well. So it's pretty clear that the blockaders are not going to find any allies or any major allies within the legislature, and that's why they're looking towards international routes as well as other provinces to hopefully get some traction for this. But you know, it just comes down to the fact that the BC government had the opportunity there, that they didn't have it, they didn't do anything about it, and well, there's no excuses at this point. They have a majority government. They had a year to talk about it. They had a year to discuss it. They had a whole old growth panel that recommended not doing anything with the forest, but they still granted the tree license. They didn't put any laws out against it, and well, they haven't spoken out against the injunction either. So John Horgan, for someone who likes to get his messaging out in the media, has been very silent this week, and that's very telling.
Yeah, and of course, we have to factor in the media as well with everything on the pandemic channel, of course, happening. And as we said in the beginning, the pandemic doesn't overshadow everything. It definitely should not. And that's why you turn to Western context for these kind of stories. Now, of course, we are turning back to the pandemic here, because there's always a question of when Canada is going to emerge from this, and it's becoming more and more apparent that Canada's made a terrible mistake with its vaccine procurement plan. For the first time in the pandemic, Canada is on track to pass the United States in new cases, COVID cases relative to population. And for the longest time, we were told day in and day out that the U.S. had failed and Canada was the model to follow. This was repeated so many times that it has stuck in the minds of Canadians and become the dominant viewpoint. That is true no longer. To address why this may be, the provinces have continually pointed to a lack of vaccine supply. This week, Doug Ford effectively said that if the province gets a vaccine, it goes into the arm of someone. His exact word was that he said, I saw a tweet from some federal minister. Oh, we have 1.3 million in the freezers. We just got those. We literally got them a few days ago. So before that, we're running out and we'll continue to run out. And this is exactly as it has been going in the provinces. They get the vaccines, they administer them, they're not sitting in the freezers, as seems to have been the inclination that some people in the media would like to turn the channel and put this problem onto the provinces. Now, Ontario, of course, is seeing an increasing spike in infections. They have prioritized hotspot regions for vaccinations, opening it up to anybody over the age of 18 who lives in a highly affected postal code. On the other side, Health Minister Patty Hajdu has made the point that over 4 million vaccines have been delivered to Ontario, but only 2.5 million were administered. In a tweet storm earlier this week, Hajdu posted statistics from other provinces as well in an attempt to paint the picture that it's the province's fault and not the fault of her own government. We also, of course, have all these tweets listed in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. When asked if she had any direct concerns in an interview about this, she wouldn't outright say yes, but from the tone of the tweets and her answers, it seems as though she wants the focus to be on the provinces. She said, quote, I think it's hard for me to give you a general answer because, of course, provinces and territories have very different strategies across the country. What I can tell you is we're watching closely and stand ready to assist any province or territory who's having a challenge rolling out vaccinations. This is a shift in narrative, putting the blame on the provinces, and it's very interesting because of the huge shipment of doses that Canada has received this week for the health minister to make this claim. The country as a whole has been receiving at least 1 million Pfizer doses a week, and that spiked to more than 2 million. This included 316,000 doses of the AstraZeneca product, which leaves just over 1 million Pfizer doses and 855,000 Moderna doses. Speaking from the perspective of Alberta, the province has been administering anywhere from a low of about 10,000 doses a day upwards to a high of just over 25,000 a day in late March. And from this, you can see it's clearly not a problem here as a matter of rollout in Alberta. Ontario has been administering upwards of 100,000 doses a day, with 2.9 million doses in total administered. The perception that the provinces are causing the lag has made it all the way into the top of the national nightly news cycle, so much so that on Global News the other day, it was the top story. Both CTV and CBC also covered the comments, but Major General Danny Forden, who is the military general in charge of the vaccine rollout, said that, "I think provinces and territories do their very best to administer as rapidly and effectively as possible vaccines to Canadians throughout the country, full stop. No one is holding on to vaccine in reserves except for local readjustments. What I would say is, and this is based off of a lot of conversations at all levels, what we see is a real desire to ensure they have a constant flow of vaccines. Anywhere from 2/3 to 75% of vaccines delivered have been administered, of course." But he also cautioned that looking at these numbers doesn't give the full picture on this. This week as well, Health Minister Patty Hajdu and Procurement Minister Anita Anand failed to show up for an emergency meeting that was called by the Health Committee, which is opposition controlled. The topics to be discussed were the safety of the AstraZeneca vaccine and vaccine supply. Now, for their part, the federal government wants to turn the channel to the provinces and ignore the problem, and the media has done nothing but help them this week. The media, as usual here, is setting the narrative, primes the public for a certain reaction, and as a result, people might start to forget soon that this whole problem started with Justin Trudeau. He spent almost 3 months working on a vaccine program with China that ultimately was a flop, when instead he should have been securing a supply agreement from our best ally, the United States.
Yeah, this whole issue has come about, and I think that a lot of people can see that the federal government really botched the vaccine response right at the beginning when it was known that vaccines were being developed. And at the moment, it was inconceivable that Justin Trudeau's government was trying to work with China on a vaccine supply when they're holding our citizens hostage, they're threatening us economically, and they are a major disruptor of civil and human rights in many parts of the world. And the fact that they weren't working with the United States from the get-go means that we are now well behind many other developed countries on a vaccine rate. And other people could say, well, it's because we have such a big country and that it's our population is very spread out. But in the end, we're the country that's closest to the United States, which is where the majority of these vaccines are being developed. And the fact that we couldn't get a better deal really comes down to the federal government. The provinces have nothing to do with that sort of thing. They're only working with what they're being given. And what they're being given is a very small amount. The fact that so few people have been vaccinated in Canada so far is really not really an indictment on the provinces. It's really a failure of the federal government to be able to get the vaccines that are needed to get this country back on a level footing. And the fact that the media has been talking way more about the provinces and going after easy cheap shot targets like Doug Ford or Jason Kenney just really goes to show that they aren't on point with what the message should actually be.
Yeah, and you know, this is something that was absolutely flooring to see this week, because it appears as though the media bought what Hajdu and the Liberals were saying hook, line, and sinker. And a vaccine agreement to get Canada vaccinated at the same rate as the U.S. would have been very simple to make. All they would have had to do is meet with the Trump administration and Pfizer and Moderna and say, whatever the U.S. is ordering, we want 10% of that when it's approved. It's as simple as that, because in general, our population is about 10% the size of the U.S. And look at how well the U.S. is doing with just using Pfizer and Moderna. If we had managed to secure even just 10%, of that U.S.-based supply would be an entirely different story here.
Yeah, exactly. And if they had not been able to make such an agreement, then it raises the question as to why Canada doesn't have domestic production of these sorts of things. Well, it comes down to liberal policies from the past and how they have dealt with the healthcare and pharmaceutical systems, leading to the fact that not many companies actually want to set up shop in Canada due to a high amount of taxes, high amounts of regulation, and, you know, just the general uncompetitiveness of the Canadian economy, which is why we have been in the situation that we have during this pandemic, where we're looking for friends among all of the foreign leaders, and we're finding very few of them because they're wanting to concentrate on their own countries. And, well, it just goes back to when Trudeau was first elected in 2015 and he said that Canada's back on the world stage. Well, it appears that no one showed up to his performance.
Yeah, and, you know, looking at this as well, if you look back and you start doing top-level research of why we don't have this, the media sources and the government as well, interestingly enough, decide to go back and point to the Brian Mulroney administration, which in itself is a very interesting exercise, but that's, of course, a topic for another show, and would be a fun thing to look into and pull apart. So maybe one day if we have a slow news week, we'll debunk the Brian Mulroney argument. But I believe we can move on to our firing line this week, talking about a story that, you know, we thought was done, but it continues on.
It continues on, and it also flew completely under the radar of the Canadian media. Now, it should be noted that we've officially passed the one-year mark of the We Charity scandal, which still sees no conclusion in sight. And, well, you might think, well, how is it the one-year mark? Well, it's because on April 5th, 2020, amidst the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, and his then-Finance Minister, Bill Morneau, held a telephone conversation discussing measures to financially assist the country's student population. Now, the finance department under Morneau was tasked with devising a series of measures to address these issues, and this would begin a chain of events involving numerous government agencies. Now, through a no-bid selection process, We Charity was chosen to administer the Canada Student Services Grant, which would have created grants for students who volunteered during the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, We Charity was founded by Craig and Mark Kielberger. They received a contract of $543.5 million to administer the Student Service Grant program, and it was officially signed on June 23rd of 2020. After this came about, it was canceled amid conflict of interest allegations against both Trudeau and Morneau, both of whose families were involved with the charity and had received compensation in the form of travel and expenses. Now, the Federal Ethics Commissioner is investigating Trudeau and Morneau over connections to the charity. Both had apologized last summer for not recusing themselves from the decision on the contract. It should be noted that both Trudeau's mother and brother were paid speaking fees and travel reimbursements to appear at We Charity events. Morneau and his family accepted trips for which they were later repaid to visit We projects in Kenya and Ecuador, and Mr. Morneau's daughter even worked for the charity for a time. And now Canada's elections watchdog has been making inquiries about whether We Charity carried out activities that benefited the Liberal Party in violation of electoral laws. This is according to a researcher who said that a senior investigator from the office recently interviewed her. Vivian Krause, who is an independent researcher and blogger, who testified about We Charity at the House of Commons Finance Committee last July, told the Globe and Mail that she was contacted in February by Louise Penton, who is a senior investigator with the Office of the Commissioner of Canada Elections. Now, Krause had raised concerns at the hearings about the Get Out the Vote activities that We Charity had conducted, and she alleged that the charity promoted Justin Trudeau, including before the 2015 and the 2019 elections. She said that Ms. Penton called her on February 22nd to discuss her testimony further. She said, quote, "It was the issue of whether We Charity should have registered as a third party. They never registered in any of the recent elections, and they should have done so. That was sort of the big question." Now, organizations in Canada that want to be active to support a particular party or candidate must register as a third party with Elections Canada. And the Commissioner of Elections Canada is responsible for ensuring compliance with Canadian election law. The Canadian Elections Act prohibits incorporated entities from making contributions, whether monetary or in kind, to political parties during campaigns. The Finance Committee has also been investigating whether connections between We Charity and the Trudeau family led the government to approve the contract for the charity to administer the pandemic aid program. Now, in what was meant to be one of its last hearings on the We Charity scandal, the Federal Ethics Committee once again refused to hear a Liberal cabinet minister who was sent to testify on behalf of the government, instead of key witnesses that the House of Commons actually had requested to hear from. Conservative MP Michael Barrett said during Thursday's committee meeting that, quote, "It's disappointing that we find ourselves for a third time experiencing the Liberals' choose-your-own-adventure style of parliamentary democracy. We're now completely jammed up with shenanigans that leave us unable to complete our report." And, well, this has made it to our quote of the week, just because it's such an interesting turn of phrase to consider the Liberals' choose-your-own-adventure of parliamentary democracy, because that's really what it is. The Liberals have time and time again leaned on democracy when it suited them and ignored it completely when it didn't. Now, last week, Government House Leader Pablo Rodriguez announced that he would testify at the Parliamentary Committee about the We Charity affair rather than Prime Minister Justin Trudeau or members of his staff. Now, the move came as all opposition parties and the Liberals are at odds with each other over a Conservative-sponsored motion passed by the House of Commons last week, calling for Mr. Rick Thace, who is the Director of Policy to the Prime Minister, and other members of Mr. Trudeau's staff, to testify before the committee. Now, Thace was instructed by the Prime Minister's office not to appear before the committee. The motion also called Defence Minister Harjit Sajjan's former Chief of Staff to appear at the Defence Committee to shed light on how the Liberals had handled the sexual misconduct allegations against the previous commander of the Canadian Armed Forces, General Jonathan Vance. And, well, that former Chief of Staff also didn't appear in the Defence Committee. Now, Rodriguez had indicated that the Liberals would ignore the motion completely, and they accused the Conservatives of trying to intimidate political staff and arguing that ministers are ultimately responsible for those who work for them. Now, this week, the Conservatives, NDP, and Bloc Québécois were all outraged that the Liberals blocked another high-ranking staffer, this time Ben Chin, who is a senior advisor at the Prime Minister's office, from testifying in front of the committee despite a formal request made in the form of a motion adopted by the House of Commons 2 weeks ago. Once again, the Liberals opted to send Associate Finance Minister Mona Fortier to testify instead, citing what they call ministerial responsibility. And once again, the opposition committee members voted to adjourn the meeting before Fortier could even utter a single word. And Bloc Québécois Rael Fortin argued during the meeting that, quote, "The committee simply does not have the authority to hear Mona Fortier today. Today we are meeting because we were ordered by the House for a simple reason, to hear Ben Chin or the Prime Minister instead of Ben Chin. At this point, the committee doesn't have the choice but to report back to the House and allow it to react accordingly." And he said this in a very annoyed tone. NDP MP Charlie Angus, who was also on the committee, expressed his discomfort at the fact the Liberals were preventing witnesses from appearing. He said, quote, It is important for us to recognize that the witnesses that were called for by Parliament did not appear. That is a fact. Conservative MP Pierre Poilievre said that if Mr. Trudeau's staff would not appear to answer the Ethics Committee's questions, then the Prime Minister himself must appear. He said, quote, "If Trudeau's staffers can't testify, then he can. We ask him to testify for no less than 4 hours before the Ethics Committee in person. He can answer why his staff were engaged in a long string of correspondence with the Wee brothers about setting up programs and grants of taxpayer money. Michael Barrett, who is the ethics critic for the Conservatives, later blasted Rodriguez's plan to attend the committee meeting instead, noting that the motion passed by a majority of MPs in Parliament specifically named Trudeau and his staff. And he said, quote, "Nowhere does it include any reference to the government House leader. For over a week, the Liberals have used the excuse that ministers should testify before the committee. The key players in Trudeau's Wee scandal work for the Prime Minister, not the government House leader. So why shouldn't he come and testify then?" Now, we could see a resolution to this major scandal one way or another if it weren't for the Liberals using every trick in the book and outside of the book to avoid the truth. But also avoiding the truth this week were the Canadian media, who outside of the Globe and Mail and the National Post did a very poor job of reporting on this story.
You know, if you look back to the testimonies that people always love to cite, and the one that everybody always loves to cite, of course, is the Richard Nixon impeachment. And the idea behind that is that in those testimonies, people were compelled to testify. And it got to a point in those cases where even the Nixon administration themselves didn't prevent these people from testifying because the dominoes were falling so fast. And we say that here, but the dominoes have already fallen. That happened last year at this point when it was lining up and it was looking as though that this scandal was looking very incriminating. This is the point at which the government should have just started letting people testify rather than hoping that it would go away. And it did go away for a bit, but because of the way the Canadian media interacts outside of the National Post and Globe and Mail on this, it could very well be possible that they could skate away on this. And this is all because, of course, in the committee system, people cannot be compelled to testify in the same way that they can in a court of law, which is something that could potentially looked at being changed for this. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, the very fact we have ministers upon ministers and government operations going on to try and, in effect, worm their way out of this, this is a huge aspect of the story that wasn't missed. And when you look at this, this points to probably nothing less than guilt. But if it is something other than guilt, maybe some kind of innocence or maybe some kind of misunderstanding, as the Prime Minister would like to say on this, well, let's hear it from them themselves and see what they have to say.
Yeah, exactly. This goes back to what the government was doing all of last summer before they prorogued Parliament, is that they were trying to avoid every single committee that was actually looking in on this issue. The Finance Committee was looking at it, the Ethics Committee was looking at it, and many other smaller ones were as well. And instead, they were trying to either not appear at all, or they were trying to waste time, or they were trying to not answer questions, and eventually they just prorogued Parliament altogether to avoid having to continue on with this. And instead, they tried to say, well, they're furloughing Parliament or proroguing Parliament just so that they can get the distancing measures in place. But, well, I mean, this happened late in the summer, well after we were into the pandemic, and they didn't arrive until later in the fall. And it was all to avoid what was going on with this. And, well, we've got Parliament back, but they're still avoiding it. And the fact that the media hasn't really talked about this story very much over the past entire year really remains to be a travesty. And the fact that the Trudeau government has continued to try and use the pandemic to shield themselves against from the truth.
Yeah, and of course they have had media help there, both in the Jason Kenney and Doug Ford files. We highlighted the differences, of course, in terms of the BC Alberta response last week, even though the fact that the restrictions look mostly the same in the two provinces, yet two different governments and two different media responses to it, despite the same restrictions put into place. And, you know, that same kind of thing, if the media wasn't focusing on that, you might have a different focus on we or the vaccines or something to that effect. And it's going to raise the question just how much more Canadians will put up with this. Of course, our listeners of Western context are very bright. They're hearing this, and hopefully you guys are sharing these stories with your friends, sharing the podcast with your friends in terms of getting the word out there, in terms of the media coverage that isn't being done right. And maybe we'll see some breakaway from the mainstream media. And with that, I think we can move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week is revolt, which is to break away from or rise against constituted authority, or to cast off allegiance or subjection to those in authority. And, well, we saw the word revolt appear many times in reference to Alberta and the 17 UCP MLAs that wanted to protest against the government's decision to enact more pandemic restrictions. But, you know, revolt could be used in many different ways this week, and not just in the obvious in Alberta. We could use it in BC, where there are a significant number of people, anywhere up to 1,000, that are revolting against the BC government's decision and the BC Supreme Court's decision to enforce an injunction against blockades protesting old growth logging. And certainly there's a revolt by the Trudeau Liberals against parliamentary committees and parliament itself, in the sense that they're going against what a majority of people have voted for in the House of Commons. And in that sense, they are not doing their due diligence to allow the people that have been summoned by these committees to testify on this major story. And in that sense, they're revolting against Parliament. And, well, revolt could be used in a different way as well when we're talking about people and how they're dealing with the vaccines that the federal government is trying to blame on the provinces for not administering. And, well, it's a dangerous time right now, and a lot of people are wanting to get back to normal life, and, well, the federal government isn't really making that happen for us.
Yeah, there needs to be a great deal of buy-in for that to work, and if we had the vaccine supplies, we'd be in a similar situation to the U.S., and it all, of course, comes back to the federal government on that. People can, of course, point to the provinces on the restrictions that are enacted and the rollout of the vaccines, but you can't very much do a rollout with no supply. And with that, you know, this is something that should be eye-opening for all Canadians this week. So hopefully that was insightful to you. And we have sources for pretty much all of the stories that we talked about this week. Many sources and videos on the Alberta story, on the BC story, and even on the vaccine story. You can find all that and more in our show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast, have it delivered automatically to you on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, pretty much any podcast listener out there. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook, where we share our shows and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always look through all the stories that the media talk about, and a lot that they aren't talking about, and quite a few that they're missing important story coverage on for the public. And no matter where we'll find them, in radio, TV, print, or online, or even if they don't exist at all, we will find them, and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for the episode of Western Context.